Good morning. On today's programme, is the London Stock Exchange in crisis and how a global wine glut is hurting Australian producers. But first we go to India. General elections in the world's biggest democracy ended yesterday after polling spread over 6 weeks. Whether Indians want to retain their controversial Prime Minister Narendra Modi for yet another 5 years will be known in 2 days' time. Sajida Momin reports.
Come Tuesday, and India's jumbo general elections will reach a climax with the counting of nearly a billion votes and the much-anticipated announcement of results after 7 rounds of polling since April. At the end of it all, the largest election in world history is about one really big thing: whether India's controversial Prime Minister for 2 straight terms, Narendra Modi, who many see as a divisive and authoritarian figure and hold responsible for democratic backsliding in the Republic, will win a 3rd term. Freedom watchdogs say that since 2014, when Modi first became the Prime Minister, India has gradually turned into an electoral autocracy and is only partly free today, with an alarming drop in political rights and civil liberties, and democratic institutions like the judiciary and the press thoroughly compromised. A hat trick by Modi's Bharatiya Janata Party could steer India away from ideals enshrined in the country's secular constitution and turn it into a Hindu nation, where religious minorities like Muslims and Christians will have no option but to live as second-class citizens. The opposition Congress Party's main election plank is saving the very idea of India, clearly spelt out in the Constitution by the founding fathers of the Republic. The Congress Party is expected to better its 2014 and 2019 performance this time, especially because it has forged tactical alliances with a string of strong regional parties. But the Congress Party-led opposition's best efforts to turn the tide are unlikely to result in a regime change. By all indications, Modi's Hindu-first Bharatiya Janata Party is set to get re-elected to govern India until 2029, although the margin of its projected victory is a matter of speculation. Even its most vehement opponents concede that only a miracle can stop Modi in his tracks and evict the ruling party from power when the votes are finally counted and the winner and loser is declared in 2 days. The sheer scale of the elections the country has witnessed from 19th April to 1st June, spread over 7 phases, is staggering and beats any other polling exercise hands down. The number of Indians casting their votes, close to a billion, is about 5 times the population of America and more than the population of all the countries of Europe combined. The number of officials deployed to conduct the elections is also a mind-boggling 15 million. And there are as many as 2,660 registered political parties in the fray. Moreover, the Bharatiya Janata Party, which is the front-runner according to most opinion polls, is the world's biggest political party with more than 180 million members. Statistics apart, the elections were held under Modi's shadow, and he has clearly outshone all other leaders who have thrown their hat into the ring and campaigned for their political parties over 6 weeks. Congress Party leaders Rahul Gandhi and Sonia Gandhi, or those who lead regional parties, simply don't seem to match his nationwide appeal and popularity. Modi, without a doubt, is India's tallest leader, but he has not set a good example during campaigning. To make Indians forget price rise, unemployment, and China's aggression at the frontier, he has turned India's 200 million Muslims, the country's largest religious minority, into a punching bag to enthuse and unite Hindu voters into rallying behind the Bharatiya Janata Party. He has publicly criticized Muslims as infiltrators and those who have a large number of children. Modi claimed in multiple campaign speeches that the Congress and other opposition parties, if voted to power, would grant benefits like positive discrimination in government jobs and educational institutions to Muslims at the expense of Hindu lower castes and tribes people. There were howls of protest as Modi falsely accused the opposition of wanting to take wealth from Hindus and to distribute it among Muslims. His hate speeches were flagged for repeatedly violating the Model Code of Conduct, which prohibits the misuse of religion during canvassing. But the poll watchdog, the Election Commission of India, remained a mute spectator as Modi took Islamophobia to new heights. It did not censure or reprimand him even once, emboldening him to cross the line again and again. Several opposition leaders have said that there are no rules left anymore for Modi. Mamata Banerjee, the feisty Trinamool Congress Party leader and chief minister of West Bengal, went to the extent of saying that Modi thinks that as prime minister, he enjoys the constitutional right to tell lies. With the temperature in New Delhi touching 52.3 degrees centigrade this week, breaking previous records, the political climate across India too is turning hotter ahead of the declaration of the results of a watershed general election. For World Report, I'm Sajida Momin in India.
To the UK next, and the London Stock Exchange has denied that it's facing a crisis as more companies decide to list their shares in New York. Firms worth hundreds of millions have delisted their shares from the UK financial market in favour of trading them in the United States. The LSE has also faced strong competition from rival stock markets in Paris and Frankfurt as investors took a negative view of the impact of Brexit. Russell Padmore has more from London.
The continuing uncertainty about the health of the UK economy has been at the centre of the political debate during campaigning here ahead of the general election scheduled for early July. It highlights how investors like pension funds are nervous about the UK. Companies sell shares to raise investment. The trading of those shares is important to the stock market as it gets a cut of the value of the transaction. The London Stock Exchange traces its roots back to 1698. To a coffee house where a list of currency, stock and commodity prices was published for the first time. In the 1840s, the development of the telegraph created a transatlantic link, which allowed stockbrokers on the floor of the LSE to see share prices at the New York Stock Exchange within minutes. Today, the motive to generate bigger profits is driving more investment funds to trade shares in New York rather than London, because companies listed on American financial markets have a greater value. The technology giant Apple alone is worth more than the combined value of the top 100 companies listed in London. Higher valuations have persuaded the microchip giant Arm to list its shares in New York rather than London. The Irish gaming group Flutter, which owns the bookmaker Paddy Power, is moving its shares to New York. And especially worrying for the British financial market is that the energy giant Shell is also considering a move across the Atlantic. If Shell quits the London Stock Exchange, its rival BP could follow, and that might also prompt big mining companies to leave. The challenges for the LSE are highlighted by the fact that pension funds have just 4% of their portfolios in British shares. The sluggish performance of the UK economy weighs heavily on the value of the shares listed here. Over the last 5 years, the FTSE 100, the index of the top 100 companies listed in London, has risen less than 10%. Meanwhile, the Dow Jones, which tracks share prices in New York, is up more than 50%. It's important for the UK to have big companies listed at the LSE because other industries like insurance, accounting, law and pensions gather around them. Financial services account for 10% of the British economy, and the sector generates about £90 billion a year in tax. That's 105 billion euro, enough to fund about half of the health service budget. The politicians trading blows ahead of the general election here on the 4th of July know that the health of the London Stock Exchange is vital for the financial well-being of the nation. The problem for the London Stock Exchange has been obvious, though, for a while. New companies floating shares for the first time on the LSE in 2021 raised £12 billion, about 14 billion euro. A year later, that fell to 338 million. The fortunes of the UK's financial market could be revived if company bosses were paid more to boost the performance of their firm. But the idea of increasing salaries for fat cat bosses would prompt a revolt by shareholders. Another way forward could be to loosen the regulations governing listed companies, but that would be more risky for investors. The British government could allow different types of shares, which would make it easier for founders of a business to keep control. But then shareholders would have less protection against bad management. The United States also allows SPACs, special purpose acquisition companies, sometimes called blank check companies. These list shares to raise funds to buy a business. But the American system of light regulation would create a bigger risk for UK investors. The chief executive of the London Stock Exchange, Julia Hoggett, recently claimed there is no sense of panic. But despite that reassurance, investors are putting their money elsewhere, notably New York. The future of the London Stock Exchange is unlikely to feature in the political debate ahead of the general election, but its problems stem from the challenges facing the British economy and how politicians will encourage businesses to invest to achieve economic growth here is very much at the heart of debates during the election campaign. A rebound in the fortunes of the London Stock Exchange will depend on significant growth of the British economy. This is Russell Padmore for World Report in London.
To Australia now, and a global wine glut is forcing more Australian farmers to dig up their vines as prices crash. Billions of litres of red wine are sitting unsold in storage tanks. Globally, wine consumption is at its lowest level since 1996. Industry analysts in Australia say that wine production has been outstripping consumption every year for the past decade. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
In 1972, Monty Python's Flying Circus famously ridiculed Australian wine as Chateau Chunder from Down Under. In the 1990s, Australia flooded the British market with cheap branded bulk wines. Back then, there was a lot to like about a bottle of Shiraz with a picture of a kangaroo on the front. But there was competition from Chile and elsewhere, and many Australian winemakers began to refashion their efforts with a focus on affordable quality. Cheaper red wines remain Australia's biggest product, but across its various wine regions, boutique producers have flourished. But there was a seismic shock in 2020. A diplomatic fallout between Beijing and Canberra resulted in sweeping tariffs being imposed on a range of Australian commodities, including beef, coal and wine. Almost in an instant, Australia's biggest and most lucrative overseas wine market disappeared. China's tariffs forced producers here to look for markets in other countries, including Vietnam, South Korea, India and Japan. China is lifting its duties, but Australian growers aren't sure that exports will ever return to what they were. Wine consumption in China is falling. It's part of a global pattern. The International Organization of Vine and Wine, an industry body, says the world consumed 221 million hectolitres of wine last year. A hectolitre is a metric unit used in agriculture that's equivalent to 100 litres. And while all that wine might sound like a lot, it does mean, however, that global consumption is at its lowest level since 1996. There's now so much surplus wine that you could swim in it. One consequence of China's trade restrictions is a huge glut of wine in Australia. It's estimated to be the equivalent of more than 850 Olympic swimming pools. Wine production around the world exceeded demand by 10% in 2023. Prices for growers have tumbled. In Australia's inland regions, prices for wine grapes have fallen by more than half over the past 3 years. Italian migrants came to Griffith in New South Wales in the 1950s and created world-class vineyards. But harsh economics are literally changing the landscape. James Cremasco watches as noisy yellow excavators rip out rows of vines that his grandfather planted. There's only so long we can go on growing a crop and losing money on it, he said. Chile, France and the United States are among other large wine makers that are also grappling with oversupply. Even prime areas in Bordeaux are uprooting thousands of hectares of vines. There are many reasons why wine is losing its luster. People are more health conscious, and there have been distinct generational shifts to other alcoholic or non-alcoholic drinks. Younger people often don't want to be soaks like their parents. The cost of living is a major factor. Good wine isn't cheap, and there's also a feeling in some quarters that the industry hasn't done enough to entice millennials and others. But it seems certain the industry here will have to contract to remain viable. The international wine trade has been struggling for years. Production has outstripped consumption every year for the past decade. And that is the industry's sober reality. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The programme was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/World Report or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, for myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.